The markets in Asia and Europe declined today as the world reacted to the historic downgrade of the U.S.'s credit rating last Friday. And Wall Street got off to a rough start this morning and its first chance to respond to the action by Standard & Poor's, losing more than 200 points at the opening bell. Then it went down to 300 points. I don't know where it is right now, but it has not recovered. In this environment of economic uncertainty, a new book recommends that we invest locally in small businesses, which account actually for 80% of all jobs in this country and one half of our gross domestic product. Amy Cortez, a journalist who has spent her career writing about business, finance, and environmental issues, makes that case in Locavesting, The Revolution in Local Investing and How to Profit from It, which is published by Wiley. I'm very pleased that it has brought Amy Cortez to our show today. Hello.
Hi, Leonard.
The locavore movement is about eating locally grown food. Is this a direct outgrowth of locavore thinking?
Yes, it very much kind of grew from that movement. And just as locavores eat a diet sourced close to home, this is investing that way.
But there's a big difference between, investing money is something that can be sent anywhere. Food is something that many people would prefer to have from some local producer because it tastes better.
Mm-hmm. And that's maybe why it started in food. With the farmers markets, people are much more aware of food, where their food is coming from, and asking those questions. But we're beginning to ask, where is our money going? And there are a lot of reasons why you want to have the local businesses in your life. They provide a lot of benefits that multinational corporations do not, yet that's where the bulk of our investments are.
Well, traveling through small-town America, as I did last week, one can't help but notice all the for rent and for sale signs on storefronts and manufacturing sites. We're moving in the opposite direction, aren't we?
Yes, but I see locavesting as a way to start rebuilding some of those communities, one community at a time, and in the process creating a stronger, more diversified national economy.
Well, how important a role do local businesses play in the American economy? Because you write, financial markets serve big businesses almost exclusively.
Mm-hmm. Small businesses, well, you mentioned, they create more than two out of every three jobs and employ more than half of Americans. They also, a dollar spent at a locally owned company generates on average three times more direct economic impact to a community than the same dollar spent at a corporate peer. And that's because spending stays local rather than being sucked out to a distant headquarters.
Well, people know this. Why is it? Why hasn't that really had much of an impact in Congress, for example?
Well, you do see the influence of this in the buy local campaigns. You see a lot of that going on across the country. This is kind of the next step. The problem is we don't have easy ways to invest locally, at least in a mainstream way.
Since the Great Recession began, the too-big-to-fail banks have become even bigger, and that despite the fact that there are grassroots movements, as you say, designed to get people to put their money into community banks. Have community banks seen any benefit from the disgust that some people have with the larger institutions?
Yeah, I think they have. They've gained members, as have credit unions. Credit unions, I think, gained 1 million members, which is quite a lot over the past year or two. But they face a lot of challenges in the too-big-to-fail world. There's a lot of pressure on them, and they continue to be squeezed and bought up by bigger banks. They've been the traditional champion of small business, but their future is very much under threat.
Well, we're talking about small business, but some of these small business are pretty big, aren't they?
Yeah, and that's an important point. A lot of people, when I talk about local investing, they think of, their local hardware store or flower shop.
Is the hardware store even taking investment?
Well, that's the thing. Maybe they don't want to. Maybe they don't need to. But so those are the quintessential local businesses, the mom and pop shops. But that's certainly not all of them. They can be multi-million dollar companies that employ hundreds of people. They could be high growth startups, anything. The distinction I make is that they are locally owned and rooted in their communities.
You're right that U.S. taxpayers fork over almost $125 billion a year to subsidize U.S. businesses. How much of that is going to the small businesses?
Very, very little. In fact, practically zero.
Despite the fact that, as we said earlier, the small businesses make up such a large part of the economy. So what are we getting back for all of that money? Where do those subsidies go?
They go straight to the deficit.
a Senate study suggested that every 1% increase in federal contracts to small businesses would create more than 100,000 jobs domestically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and for all the reasons we've talked about, small businesses are the job creators. Multinationals, for years, have been hiring more overseas, eliminating jobs domestically, and even as their profits are at record highs, wages in this country have been stagnating or going down. These are some of the problems attack all big businesses, but a lot of our biggest corporations are not doing us any favors, let's face it, yet they are the ones that are getting our taxpayer subsidies.
And why is that? You write, despite all the rhetoric in support of small businesses in Washington, only 5% of all federal contracts are actually awarded to small businesses.
There's a lot of game playing that goes on. Companies can distort and pervert things. But, I mean, mainly the reason we have this situation more broadly is the close link between money and politics. And I think until we sever that, we are going to have our big, powerful corporations and their lobbies dictating our rules.
You write about a number of entrepreneurs who have built up small businesses. Can you talk a bit about Jessica Stockton? Is it Bagnulo?
Bagnulo, yes.
She did something that I would have thought is kind of crazy. She opened a bookstore.
A bookstore? How about it? Yeah, she and her partner, Rebecca Fitting, they were looking to open a bookstore, and they were looking in Fort Greene in Brooklyn, not far from where I live. And they had personal savings. They had some kind of a New York City loan, and they were hoping to get a bank loan. But then, of course, this was in 2009, right after the financial crisis, and banks were not lending. So they had already been welcomed very warmly by the neighborhood, which really wanted a local bookstore in Fort Greene. There are a lot of writers that live there. So there were relationships that had been established, and these two women, Rebecca and Jessica, went back to that group and said, hey, would you guys be willing to lend us some money? And you know what? Two dozen people stepped up, lent them $70,000. They could choose an interest rate between 2.5% and 4%. Many of them chose the lower, but today they're their best customers.
But to be honest, if somebody asked me to invest in a bookstore, from what I've seen, not just Borders closing, Barnes & Noble in trouble looking for somebody to buy it. There are a couple of local bookstores in my neighborhood that are obviously on their last legs. There's just too much competition from Amazon and from the people reading Nooks and Kindles. Who's out there except for some writers who want to have books?
Well, there are actually a lot of people out there who do want their local bookstore. And yes, even as Borders is going bankrupt and Barnes & Noble is shutting down locations, in New York City, we've seen a revival of indie bookstores. And that's because people like what they provide. They're better curated. They have events. They bring people together. It's different than clicking a button on Amazon.
My guest is Amy Cortese, C-O-R-T-E-S-E, her book Locavesting, The Revolution in Local Investing and How to Profit from It. It is published by Wiley. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate, and a reminder that any moment now the president will be talking about the current situation, both with the downgrading of the U.S. Credit by Standard & Poor's Afghanistan and whatever else comes up. But right now we are continuing this conversation on Locavesting, And you write about a community northwest of Seattle that's made investing locally very easy and profitable. They call it LINE, Local Investment Opportunity Network.
Yeah, and that's a very easy thing that any community could do. It was a group of citizens, and they had just found themselves when somebody in the community, when a business needed funding, it all started with their food co-op, wanted to move locations. So people would come together, help them raise some money, and then disband. And then, again, after the financial crisis, which prompted a lot of these things, they decided to formalize it a little bit more and create this LION group. So businesses in the area come to them when they need funding. And they're not investing together, but they're looking at the deals, and some people may choose to invest, some may not, some may team up, but they've invested.
This is like microbanking, isn't it?
Yeah, sure, but hyper-local, and they've invested in things like a creamery, a sparkling cider maker, a small real estate development, a bike shop, and mm-hmm. they've had a big impact on their community.
So what happens? I'd invest in this LION and hope to make a profit? The same as if I had put my money into some mutual fund?
You're taking a little bit more of an active role. So you're part of this LION group. So
I would be one of the deciders as to where to put the money.
They're not deciding together, though. So they're inviting the companies in to pitch them, and then each individual will decide if they want to invest or not. So it's a very loosely knit group.
But we don't have anything like that in New York. So if I were interested in supporting some local company, where would I go?
There aren't a lot of easy places to do that right now. But in New York, there's a group called Slow Money New York City, which I'm actually part of. And we are considering creating a LION-like investment group here. There's another variation of that where it's actually a club where everyone's actively involved and you as a group, make a decision on where to invest your money. So you could join a group like that. There are chapters all over the country. And probably the easiest thing right now that people could do to make sure that their money gets put to use locally is to invest with a local bank or credit union, because the chances of that money being lent out locally are much better than with, say, Chase Manhattan Bank.
How do small businesses compete with all of the online merchandisers now?
Same way anybody does. I mean, and it works both ways. So you might be a small local business, but suddenly you can expand your potential base of customers and reach out much more easily.
Well, some people do want to be able to touch the thing that they're buying.
Right.
I've always wondered about people who buy shoes online, for example. How can you buy shoes
Never
online
works.
without trying it on? But also, women's clothing generally, you have to go into that fitting room and see how it works, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
I could buy a shirt online, but and even then, I want to look at it. Mm-hmm. But it seems that that's the way of the future, isn't it?
I think we're always going to have a mix for some of the reasons you bring up. But also, if you're paying attention to where your money is going, you know that by shopping online at the big online retailer, that money is going just straight out of your community, you know, to some headquarters, and then ultimately to, you know, the Chinese factory where the product was made.
Well, it is interesting that a company like Ben & Jerry's started just this way,
mm-hmm.
and now Ben & Jerry's is owned by some huge conglomerate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ironic, but their early investors did very well in Ben & Jerry's.
So, those investors. But are there Ben & Jerry's, new kinds of Ben & Jerry's out there?
There are. And Ben & Jerry's did what's called a direct public offering. So they went public in the state of Vermont without Wall Street involvement, and they sold the shares directly to their customers who loved their ice cream. They were a tiny ice cream shop then, and they advertised it with "Get a Scoop of the Action." And they raised, I forget how much, under $1 million. That was in 1984. And then the next year they went public. with an IPO, and so those early investors made out very well. And that's sort of coming back, that idea of the DPO, because our public markets have gotten – it's very costly to go public now, so there's a whole swath of companies that can't afford it. A DPO lowers the cost and makes that more accessible for more companies.
Have you or people involved in this been speaking to members of Congress?
I know there are conversations going on. I have not, but Mary Shapiro at the SEC has acknowledged that the SEC laws, which pretty much guide all of our investment behavior, what we're allowed to do and what we're not allowed to do, she's acknowledged that the laws as written, and by the way, they were written in the Depression era and are woefully outdated, and they're really hampering capital formation for small businesses.
Well, there's also the added problem of the current economic environment and Congress saying we don't want to give money to anybody, although it does make sense to reverse things and, as you say, give money to small businesses and encourage the employment that brings. That's not where we're going right now.
No, and you know what's really scary is that no one seems to have a plan. I mean, Washington is in complete gridlock. Wall Street's not going to come in and save us, nor is corporate America, who's been sitting on their cash piles. That's why this is a grassroots movement. And I look at it as a grassroots stimulus program that won't cost the government a dime. Americans have around $26 trillion, actually maybe a lot less today, invested in various securities, including corporate bonds and stocks. If they shifted even just 1% of that to local investing, that's $260 billion injected into the Main Street economy.
Well, I guess this all sounds great, but if I were an investor, I really wouldn't know where to go right now, would I?
No, you might not. And that's why I wrote this book.
And where would I go?
To show people how it's done and where you can go. But as I mentioned, there's a lot of innovation and experimentation going on right now. So there aren't a lot of mainstream ways to do this. But you could start with local banking. You could look for a community development loan fund. Those are two very conventional, traditional ways to invest locally. Crowdfunding is a very interesting area with new startups that are helping people invest in small businesses, although it's tricky working around the SEC laws. You could start a club like Lion, we talked about in Port Townsend, and other areas are doing that. There are direct public offerings. You could join a slow money group. There's actually quite a bit.
A listener, Jeff, left this comment. He said, when I started my business, I would not take money from friends and family because I didn't want to put the personal relationships at risk. The business was a success, but if it had failed, I would have likely lost both my livelihood and my friends. So what happens when the local business fails? While I'm not suggesting that anonymous Wall Street investing or venture capital is better, they do remove the risk of ruining personal relationships when businesses fail.
That's a very good point. And no business is risk-free, right? So there's always that possibility that it could fail. A couple ways to answer that, but there's one.
If he held on to his Xerox stock, he would not be as happy as he would have been when he invested in it in 1972.
You're right, I guess. But there's a company called ProFounder out of California, and they're doing just that. They're helping take that kind of messy process of raising money from friends and family and putting a little bit more of a process around it and helping manage it so that you don't ruin those relationships. So they call that community funding because it's not really the anonymous crowd. It's your social network. But yeah, that's a risk you have to take. On the other hand, I think that like the Greenlight Bookstore example, their lenders have become their best customers. So they have a vested interest in seeing that bookstore succeed. And they're very proud to be part of it. I'm sure if they had a trouble paying back their loan, people would be understanding and give them a little bit more time. It's just your goals are a little bit more aligned and there's just a little bit more synergy there than you would have in Wall Street.
Doesn't this make a lot more sense in a small community that is trying to maintain itself, fight against the invasion of the big box stores, than in a big city like New York?
No, I think it's appropriate in both places. I mean, there's actually quite a lot happening in New York, mainly in Brooklyn at this point. But, you know, we have slow money groups. We have the Green Light.
And why do you think it is Brooklyn? I mean, it is true. Brooklyn just seems to have developed a sense of community that is almost separate from the rest of the city, to the point where I'm a Brooklynite, but where mm-hmm. people from other parts of the city are annoyed when they even hear that I'm from Brooklyn and mm-hmm. I love being there.
Well, I think we're very fortunate in Brooklyn that we still have retained that, you know, the independence, the mom and pop shops were not full of chain stores like, unfortunately, some of my older neighborhoods in Manhattan are today. So I think we value that. And at the same time, you have an incredible amount of entrepreneurship happening. Just look at the Brooklyn Flea and all these people making pickles and chocolates and gin and beer and wine in Brooklyn. And I think there's a big appetite for that. And some of those companies are going to end up being very successful, and they need capital to get to the next level. So I think there's a lot of you know, I think living in Brooklyn, you can see this happening, and there are a lot of companies you could see that you would want to invest in and be part of.
Would you like to see the president say anything along these lines in the near future? He's not going to say anything today about this, but you think this is even something that's being discussed in the White House?
I don't think yet, but I would love to see it be discussed there. I mean, there's a lot of talk about supporting small business in Washington, and so much of it is lip service, because then they turn around and everything we do benefits the biggest corporations, the biggest, wealthiest, most well-connected corporations.
Well, there are small business lobby groups, but they don't seem to have the impact, obviously, that the larger businesses do, the large mm-hmm. Lobby, the very wealthy lobby groups. So is it simply a matter, do you think, of gaining access through money?
Possibly. Yeah, the Chamber of Commerce talks a lot about small business, too, but I don't think that's their real aim.
Eric has written on our show page, isn't there something to be said for geographic diversification? What happens if there's a regional economic slowdown?
Well, yes, that's a downside of, you know, if you had all of your money invested locally, that would not be a good thing. That's why most locavestors are investing a portion, maybe 5%, 10%, 20%. I know people who are investing actually much more than that. But yes, you would have that concentrated geographic risk. But 10%, 20% even, you're diversifying your overall portfolio. And these companies should provide some measure of you know, a buffer from the global economic shocks that we experience with all too much regularity.
Robert in Brooklyn writes, what about Kickstarter.com? Can you talk about its possible relevance?
Yeah, Kickstarter is a great example. They've been wildly successful. I think they're up to $1 million in pledges per week. So it shows that people are willing to put a lot of money into these enterprises or projects that they believe in. The problem with Kickstarter is you're basically donating money. You might get a CD back or a T-shirt, but you're not getting a financial return. So imagine if you could take that model, but also promise a financial return if that company did well. And I think that would really crack it wide open.
Jake asks, can you name any investors interested in incubating great but small businesses in New York and New Jersey?
Can I name any investors?
That's what he wrote.
Well, again, Slow Money is doing some of this.
How would I'd look up smallmoney.com.
Com or S-L-O-W.
Yeah, like slow food.
Money, yeah.
All NYC. Of this goes back to the food movements, I guess.
It does.
They become the inspiration for everything else because that was a major grassroots approach to something that had seemed to be getting out of hand.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Agribusinesses.
Yeah. And you want to see who makes your food and it tastes so much better and, you know, you get a measure of local security, food security, so you're not importing everything from far away.
So where would I, how would I contact these places?
It's all in my book. I put resources in every chapter, but I think Slow Money, I mean, it's easily Googleable, Slow Money NYC, and then there's a national organization, Slow Money. But yeah, Slow Money is always looking for new members.
Well, we are still waiting to hear from the president, who originally said that he was going to be speaking at 1 o'clock. This is not unusual. We have had, I remember the last time the president gave a major speech, which was about the assassination of Osama bin Laden. People were treading water for hours before he finally came on and gave the speech. This is an important thing that he's going to be talking about. Interestingly, it's related to what we're talking about here, the American economy and why it is sick right now. And yet, as we've established during this conversation, practically no one is talking about this approach.
Mm-hmm. Well, the crazy thing is it's easier to invest in a company halfway around the world than one in your own backyard. And that's because of our SEC laws, which were created in the Depression era. And what they did was basically create two tiers of investors. If you're rich, you can invest in private companies, venture capital, hedge funds, whatever you want. The rest of us are pretty much confined to the stock market. And that worked out well for a long time. But these days, I mean, there's a certain irony in the fact that, you know, in the name of protecting investors, you're forcing us to play in the stock market. And I don't know if anyone feels that that's a safe bet anymore.
Well, you can't do day trading in this, can you? Can you lose your shirt nonetheless?
Day trading is not really what this is all about. And one of the things we haven't talked about is local stock exchanges, which would kind of be a linchpin for a lot of these different local investing strategies.
Are there local stock exchanges?
There are some in the works. Nothing that's been done yet, but Lancaster, Pennsylvania is trying to do one. Hawaii is interesting because it imports 85% of its food and energy. And there's a lot of wealth on the island, but it's all invested on the mainland. So a local stock exchange would keep wealth local and let them nurture some homegrown companies so that they're more self-sufficient. They don't have to import everything.
We're starting to see more of that happening here in the city. Again, Brooklyn, there was a time when a lot of companies were manufacturing local products, beers and such, Domino Sugar, and they all left. And now we're seeing smaller versions of those companies come back, perhaps because we miss them, perhaps because actually we can do a better job than what's being done in their names. Is there even a Rheingold beer anymore, a Schaefer beer, a Peel's?
I don't know.
Ballantine? But if there are, you can be sure that they're not as good as some of the local breweries. I guess when you make it local, you can often make it a lot better than if you're doing it on a large, one-size-fits-all approach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I happen to be a big fan of our local beers, and there is something to be said about beer when it's fresh. It's just, you know, it's a night and day difference. And by the way, the Pabst and the...
And we're starting to grow things in New York City as well.
We
have little farms all over town.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, industrial manufacturing has been on a long downward slope in New York City, but food-based manufacturing has actually been rising lately. And the Bloomberg administration recently created a fund to help nurture that. So they even see the promise in this.
Scott Stringer also has been pushing for this sort of thing in Manhattan. It seems to me that our politicians are way behind on this.
Yeah.
We just had a 2-minute warning that the president will be speaking about the current situation. And right now, by the way, on AM, we already are bringing you NPR coverage of the impact of Friday's U.S. credit downgrade. We will be switching on both AM and FM to the president's speech once it actually happens from the White House. And then WMYC will continue coverage into the next hour. My great thanks to Amy Cortese.
Thank you, Leonard.
Wait, I haven't finished. The book is called Locavesting, The Revolution in Local Investing and How to Profit from It. It's published by Wiley, and I suspect that there are a couple of things you're going to walk out of here saying, gee, I wish I had talked about. You want to give us one or two of them?
Yeah, there's a bunch of things, but you were just talking about what cities are doing, but there is a big shift in the economic development mentality of states, where they used to go for the big game and try and bring in the big box or the big plant that would, you know, employ hundreds of people, but then they'd get into competition, you know, have to give them all sorts of tax breaks just to move there, and it ended up being a losing proposition for a lot of states.
We've been doing that in the city as well.
Yes, we all have. Well, now there's sort of a change in mindset, and in the book I talked to the state of Illinois, their economic development head, and he said, well, you know, we have 500,000, I think it was, small businesses in Illinois. If we helped each one of them hire one person.
And here is President Obama speaking from the White House. Thank you so much.
Our ability